The Brothers Karamazov was Fyodor Dostoevsky's last novel, and many feel it's also his greatest. It's a combination murder mystery, courtroom drama, and a look at the rivalry and love affairs involving a father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, and his sons, Dmitry, Ivan, Alyosha, and Smerdyakov. The book is also important to Richard Prevere and Larissa Volokhansky because it's the first translation they ever worked on together. The NEH grant they received to complete it helped them start a new life in Paris, and the final product earned them their first Penn Book of the Month Club Translation Prize. Richard and Larissa join us now from Paris to talk about this novel. I'm pleased to welcome them back to our show. Thanks for participating in the Leonard LoPage Show Book Club.
Thank you for having us.
We're pleased to be here again.
And we also invite our listeners to participate. You can call us at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at WMIC.org or tweet us at Leonard LoPage. And I should tell you that we've already been receiving a lot of questions, which I will get to as this conversation progresses. When did each of you first read The Brothers Karamazov, and how did you react to it? Richard, how old were you?
I must have been 19, I think, 18 or 19. I took a summer school course in English of Russian literature with a wonderful professor, Vladimir Markov. He was from California, but he was spending the summer at Harvard in order to see all of Bergman's films. There was a big Bergman festival.
So you read it only because it was assigned in a class?
No, I was happy to read it. That's why I took the class, but... I read it in English, of course.
And did you think it was a great book at the time?
I did so, yes. It was a very, very striking book.
And Larissa, I assume you originally read it in Russian.
Yes, I read it in Russian many times. Very early in my life. I don't remember when. But I was a very avid reader since very early in my life. And then I kept rereading it every once in a while. So by the time Richard and I decided to translate it, I knew it pretty well.
But why this book that had already been translated so many times? Wouldn't there have been another book that perhaps was crying out for a decent translation?
Well, yes. The thing is that we were both rereading the book at the same time. We've talked about this before. And I was reading it in a new translation by David Magarshak. And Larissa said, I want to see how it goes. And she started reading it in Russian. And then she would come running over to me and say, how do they do this? And we would look, and she said, they don't do it. And then another time, how did they translate that? And then she looked and said, oh, they didn't translate it. And suddenly a little light went on in my head, and I thought, what are we missing in English that's essential to Dostoevsky?
And it's interesting that when... go ahead. I'm sorry.
I suddenly realized that Richard is reading a slightly different book from what it really is. And that's why we started thinking in this direction.
Well, when Magashak's translation came out, everybody said, well, it covered all sorts of things that the Constance Garnett, the original translation, hadn't had. So each new translation tries to get the real Dostoevsky?
Well, I think there's a little more to it in the case of Dostoevsky. He had a reputation, especially if you read someone like Nabokov, his opinion of him. But very, very frequently you would read that Dostoevsky didn't write very well, but he was a great thinker.
Well, Nabokov did not admire Dostoevsky.
Not at all, no. Although he wrote like him.
technically, Nabokov took a lot more from Dostoevsky than from other writers that he admired, like Tolstoy.
But he was critical of Dostoevsky's style. He felt that he was kind of a rough writer.
Right. Yes, and this was the thing that began to dawn on me that made this work so important for us, that the whole stylistic side of Dostoevsky had been misunderstood, even by Russians. We had a dear friend, an elderly lady, When we said we were translating the Karamazov, she said, "I hope you correct its awful style." and I said, "On the contrary, we're going to put it back in because."
I suspect that Nabokov sort of inherited this attitude, because when I read his lectures on Russian literature, I realized that he, by the time he wrote these lectures or made notes for them, he hadn't reread Dostoevsky for a long time, because he makes even factual mistakes. So, and he inherited this attitude of the early 20th century when Dostoevsky was considered a poor stylist, and that changed in time.
Hasn't that been explained by the fact that this book originally appeared in a serialized form, and so Dostoevsky was writing it on the fly?
No, by the time he was writing Karamazov, he had all the time he needed.
Oh, so he didn't do this serialized as he had done his earlier
works? He did serialize it, but he could work on it. He could rewrite it as much as he wanted. He wasn't pressed for time the way he was with Crime and Punishment.
You write that this was the most symmetrical of his novels. You also say that despite the subject matter, it is a joyful book.
Yes, the joy is in the language. The joy is in the composing of the voices of the book, and this is what Dostoevsky is a great master at, and that for some reason some translators decided that should be toned down considerably because they didn't understand that it's a drama of opposing voices, and each one is very clearly characterized, very strongly characterized.
It seems that a whole class of students from California have written in questions to our show about the book. Their teacher, Colleen, wrote in first. She asks, "I teach the Brothers Karamazov to high school seniors, and every year I read it, I'm struck by the vitality of the language. What were some of your challenges in translating it?"
Well, Richard just mentioned these many voices, that each character has his own way of expressing himself or herself, including the narrator. So for each character, we had to work on a very specific way of talking, of expressing himself. There's also a lot of verbal humor, wordplay. There are proverbs, sayings, little phrases, and they all should... For all of them, we should find the equivalents.
Now, the narrator uses, as you point out, a lot of humor and irony. For instance, after introducing the three brothers and their deeply troubled childhoods, he refers to them as a nice little family.
Yes.
Yeah, Dostoevsky uses a diminutive word for family, semeichka.
Semeika.
And if you say a nice family or whatever, it doesn't catch that. We had to say a nice little family.
The narrator also chooses to withhold and introduce bits of information of interesting moments. For instance, we only find out that Ivan has a brain disorder moments before he has his pivotal hallucination.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess so, yes. I don't know if that's...
Well, but the point is that the narrator sometimes plays with us. He gives us, and then he... who should we assume the narrator actually is? Dostoevsky himself?
No. Dostoevsky is removed, one step removed from the narrator.
He's somewhat remote. He sometimes is there. He becomes just a regular third-person narrator. But then all of a sudden the narrator will say, I didn't understand this, or I didn't find this out till later, and he stumbles over his own narration. So it's,
Melissa from Manhattan asks, "I'd love to know how Dostoevsky's voice of the narrator compares to other writers of the time. He's almost imperceptible initially, and then starting with book 5, I think, he becomes more of a presence. How would you explain that?" And she also wondered if he was a stand-in for Dostoevsky.
No, he definitely does not stand for Dostoevsky, although occasionally Dostoevsky sort of merges with him. And I don't think that he only appears in book 5. I think he appears from the very first lines of the book, It's very clear because of this constant, it's stylistically clear. You know, he constantly stumbles all over himself, and he makes lame jokes, and he sometimes talks with great uncertainty. Remember when there is a question of whether Fyodor Pavlovich is Smerdyakov's father, whether he raped or whatever, Lizaveta Smerdyashchaya, all of a sudden the narrator becomes very vague. It's that they say, perhaps, maybe, we will never really know, although clearly Dostoevsky wants us to know that Fyodor Pavlovich is Smerdyakov's father, because it's a novel about brothers. Mm-hmm. There are four brothers, and you mentioned it in the beginning when you introduced the novel. You said three brothers,
I said four brothers because he
has. Right.
I said his sons, which is different.
Right, his son, right.
They're two half brothers.
His sons, and this is very good and right to always remember it when you read the novel, because the narrator does a lot to sort of avoid speaking about it directly.
My guess,
this is Dostoevsky's intention.
My guess are Larisa Volokhansky and Richard Prevere, who have did their first translation, a collaborative translation of the Brothers Karamazov, available these days in a paperback from Farrar, Straus and Giroux. We have a web extra starring Richard and Larisa on our show page at WMIC.org, where they reveal their translation process, talk about what they like to read, and offer suggestions for both old and new fans of Russian literature. We invite your participation. You can write to us on our show page at WMIC.org, on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate, or you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. Getting back to that California class that I mentioned earlier, one of Colleen's students, Sierra, points out that Dostoevsky alludes to many other literary works within the novel. She asks, since many of the reference works are from other Russian writers, it stands to reason that many of the allusions needed not only to be translated themselves, but needed to be translated with Dostoevsky's interpretation of each work in mind. Were there any challenges in preserving the integrity of Dostoevsky's analysis of this work? Is that clear to you? Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought about that.
Well, this is a smart kid, obviously.
Yeah. His writing is full of allusions and parodies and borrowings, and especially of he liked to tease Turgenev, who had been mean to him once and wouldn't lend him money, and he always held it against him. But Gogol, of course, is everywhere in Dostoevsky. He spent his life trying to respond to the challenge of Gogol.
Hey, you just go ahead.
But yeah. he is in conversation, and he has an argument with Gogol, because he does something Gogol did, but then he does something else with it.
And I assume that educated Russian readers at the time would have understood all of that inside talk.
Yes, they would, most of the time. Every once in a while there is a hidden quotation from a more or less obscure poem,
or an early Syrian saint, like Isaac the Syrian. Who plays a very important part in the novel.
Now, you just released a translation of Dostoevsky's Notes from a Dead House. Isn't that usually called House of the Dead? Why the name change?
Well, why did the other translators change it is what we would like to know.
He called it Notes from a Dead House?
From a Dead House, yeah. It's the house that's dead. The people are very much alive.
So he had Notes from the Underground and Notes from a Dead House?
Mm-hmm. He started with Notes from a Dead House. It's virtually an account of his own 4 years in a hard labor prison camp. And the experience there was fundamental to him. It changed his whole vision of human life. And he was quite aware of that. It took him some years to be able to write it.
But well, it had to be very traumatic, especially because he was put before a firing squad at one time as a joke.
Yeah. Yeah, the joke from the Tsar.
Isn't there a connection?
This echoes all the way through to the Brothers Karamazov.
That's what I was going to ask you about, a connection between that book and the Brothers Karamazov.
Yeah, certainly. What Dostoevsky discovered in the prison was the immense diversity within a single human being, capacities for evil and for good, and the struggle in them that constantly goes on. You see it especially in Mitya Karamazov, who's the most sort of the most instinctive and uncontrolled character of the four brothers, but certainly also in Ivan, certainly, and in Alyosha also. Alyosha says, "I too am a Karamazov."
Now, Yosha is named after Dostoevsky's son who had died, his three-year-old son, Alexei, mm-hmm. who died around that time. He gives the saintly brother the name of his child. But why did he name the murdered, hardly lovable central character, the father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, after himself?
That's a good question.
Well, his name is Fyodor Mikhailovich. So
but still, Fyodor, people had to have noticed.
Yeah, yeah.
If I wrote a novel with the main character named Leonard, people would, or if Proust has his character Marcel, that's all we talk about for the first class course. When we're studying that. Another one of our student book club participants, Marcella, asked about the theme of forgiveness in The Brothers Karamazov. Wasn't Dostoevsky's take on forgiveness and spiritual redemption formed by his trouble with the law?
You mean by his arrest? And
yes.
His life in prison.
And being sentenced to death and all of the rest that happened.
Yes, certainly, certainly.
And then while he was in prison, he met another person who would affect the plot of the Brothers Karamazov, a man named Ilyinsky.
Ilyinsky, yes. He is a sort of sketch of Mitya.
Yeah, because he turns out to be innocent.
He's accused of killing his father, and after 10 years of a 20-year sentence, they find the real murderer, and he is released. But he's a very interesting character. He's a very powerful and yet meek character. Very, very, a very rich figure.
Also very cheerful, full of life. So is Mitya. And Mitya is prepared to even to suffer. He's prepared to suffer.
Even though he didn't kill the old man.
Even though he's not guilty.
People often talk about the Grand Inquisitor chapter. Why is it so important?
Well, it's very often taken out of context. It's called, for instance, the Legend of the Grand Inquisitor, which Dostoevsky never called it. And people forget that it's Ivan who wrote it.
And Ivan is a murderer, really. I mean, I'm
well, you're pinning the murder on him.
Well, he is Smerdyakov's mentor. Smerdyakov, in his own way, loves Ivan, and he thinks that Ivan wants this, wants him to do it, and he does it.
So he kills because he thinks he's doing it for Ivan, but Ivan, of course, is horrified that done it in his name. But he says, well, I am the murderer. He takes responsibility.
Yeah, he finally does.
Yes, it finally dawns on him. Ivan himself doesn't know that he wants it until he realizes it, and then he goes mad.
Now,
it is then.
Go ahead.
It's then that he becomes, starts seeing the devil and argues with him. And the devil, incidentally, sometimes speaks exactly like Fyodor Pavlovich.
But you asked about the legend of the Grand Inquisitor. It is a fascinating separate piece. A lot of philosophers have written about it, commentary, long commentaries on it. In Russian philosophy, it's a central text. But I think that people forget that it's connected with Ivan. They tend to treat it as if it's Dostoevsky speaking or Dostoevsky writing it, when it's actually Ivan who composes this very strange apology for evil and very strained. And Alyosha, when he hears him, when he finishes reading it, he just stares at him and said, I forget what he says. He said,
"Well, isn't this?"
In fact, he kisses him.
But isn't this part of?
He realizes that he's suffering. He sees in it the suffering that Ivan is going through, and he embraces him, like the Christ in the legend.
He says, "Your Grand Inquisitor simply doesn't believe in God." This is what he says.
Yeah.
But part of the Dostoevsky's greatness is that he can write so convincingly from the minds of people who are nothing like he is.
But so you see, this is your judgment. There's he learned in the prison camp was that when you say nothing like he is, he realized that we are all of it. You know, somewhere in us is all of it, and he could put himself into someone like Ivan, someone like Smerdyakov. The characterization of Smerdyakov is brilliant and very funny because it's this inner richness in human personality and contradictoriness. So no one is even sure if Dostoevsky believed in God. He did, I suppose. I assume, but he also could be very cagey in the way he talked about it.
It is this caginess is a very interesting thing, because in Dostoevsky it's very, very important not only what he does say, but what he does not say. For instance, we talked about Smerdyakov being one of the brothers. One of the sons, one of the brothers.
Well, he's
also
the one born out of wedlock.
Out of wedlock, but still the father is Fyodor Pavlovich, and he's half brother to them, but it is never mentioned directly, and we need to enter the mind of Smerdyakov. Smerdyakov means the stinking one. His mother is. Mother's nickname is Smerdyashche, the stinking Lizaveta, and he is Smerdyakov, and he is Fyodorovich. He's Pavel Fyodorovich. You know, it's all this play with names, and he's stinking one, the son of the stinking woman, and he's always referred to as stinking lackey, never as a brother. Imagine how he should feel. And also, you know, Ivan, for instance, all this talk about suffering children, and look at Smerdyakov's childhood. Smerdyakov's childhood is described. He was always Grigory told him all kinds of horrible things, and Ivan in real life doesn't care about children at all. He doesn't even pay attention to children.
We have
it's
to leave
very,
it there.
Very complicated and very subtle.
It is a very great book, and my great thanks to both of you for talking about it with
a big
us.
Pause.
Well, I've run out of time, but we have some extra starring Richard and Larissa on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, of course, is The Brothers Karamazov. Their translation is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux.